Where'd all you guys come from? Anybody been asleep yet? Couple. Y'all realize it's 10 a.m., not p.m.? A little compulsive, alcoholic. My name's John, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm tickled to be here at Founders Day. This is great. I want to thank the committee for inviting us to come. Mark's been great. Harmon picked us up yesterday at the airport, and it's just been wonderful. And last night, weren't the old timers great? They're just wonderful. I forgot, we don't call them old timers anymore. We call them long timers. I don't know why. Well, it's politically correct in AA. You know, I'm amazed that I get invited to things like this, because I don't do this very good. And I don't do AA very good. I wish I did AA better, but I don't, you know. But I don't know anybody that does, really. I love that meeting after the meeting when you're out having coffee, you know, and you're trying to help another alcoholic who's usually not there. You know, you're just talking about them a little bit, trying to help them out. Somebody inevitably says, right, they say, oh, yeah, I know that guy. He talks the talk, but he can't walk the walk. Who are we kidding? None of us can walk the walk. I mean, if I could walk the walk, I wouldn't need to come to AA. You know? I come to AA because I can't walk the walk. I think that's what the book says, doesn't it? Doesn't the book say that? When it gets through reading the 12 steps, what does it say? It says, wow. What an order. Can't go through with it. Don't be discouraged. No one. They don't exclude anybody. They don't exclude Bill Wilson. They don't exclude Dr. Bob. They certainly don't exclude John Allred. See, no one among us has been able to maintain anything like. You know what that means, maintain anything like? Haven't even come close. You know, perfect adherence to these principles. So nobody can do this deal. Yet those of us don't do it, like talking about the rest of you that can't. I don't do it better than he don't do it. But that's really not my fault. See, I am an adult child of non-alcoholics. That's a real bitch. I mean, I got nobody to blame. You know, nobody in my family drank. Nobody drank. My dad didn't drink. Mom didn't drink. Brother don't drink. I didn't drink. Growing up, I grew up in a very middle-income America household. You know, we never moved in the middle of the night. You know? The light always came on. You turn the light switch, the light comes on. You know? It's amazing. I went to college like you're supposed to, never drank. Got married my senior year like you're supposed to, you know, never drank. Got out, I went in the insurance business, Salt Lake City, and things are pretty good. I'm scared. I don't know what I'm afraid of, but I go to work in the morning, secretary come give me these little messages, you know, pink. I said, what are these? She said, those are your phone messages. I said, who from? I don't know. What do you think they want? I guess they want to buy insurance, you know. See, phones are scary. Aren't phones scary? I mean, I like to have a phone, and I want to make phone calls, but I don't want you calling me. And that phone, ring, 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 ring. Yeah. I want to tell you, you young alcoholics, you got it made. You have no idea the terror there is in having a telephone with no caller ID. That's a scary ass deal right there. I want to tell you that. You know, that phone, ring, 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 ring. Who is it? We used to walk around that phone, look at that phone. Who's calling me? And then we got those answering machines, which was real good because you could screen your calls, you know. Problem is that somebody would call you and then hang up. No message. And then you got to walk around all day thinking, well, who would call and not leave their message? That'll make you have a drink right there. That'll make you have a drink. I want to tell you, all that technology, that caller ID and answering machines, that stuff was all invented by alcoholics for alcoholics. Makes it a lot easier to stay drunk. A whole lot easier. But I had a buddy named Stuart. Stuart drank. He drank in the bar. So I started hanging out with Stuart. I love the bar. And, see, you know, the bar, you can be anything you want to be in the bar. Anything you want to be, you can be. And I'd go down to the bar, he'd drink whatever he drank, whiskey, I'd drink Coke. Never drank in the bar, drink Coke. But you can be anything you want to be. We get down to the bar, we get some women over the table. They say, what do you do for a living? I like to do a lot of stuff, you know. Sometimes I'd retire. 24-year-old retiree. I said, you must have made a lot of money. Oh, yeah. That's why I drive a Toyota. You know? I love to be the mystery man where you don't really tell them what you do. You know, they say, what do you do? Oh, nothing. I can't. Well, you got to do something. What do you do? Well, listen, I can't talk about it, okay? Just drop it now. I can't talk about it. Right? Okay, one thing, and then we got to drop it. Let's just say I work for the government, okay? That's what I'm going to say about it. That's what I'm going to say about it. Okay, one more thing. Then we got to drop it. If I leave here real quick, you better come after me because there's some shit going down here tonight. That's all I'm going to say about it. That's all I'm going to say about it. I love to be that mystery guy. By the way, I'm doing all that sober. I ain't started drinking yet. Because, see, I lie. I told you. I'm so good at lying, I don't know I'm lying. That's how good a liar I am. Don't know I'm lying. A lot of people call that denial. But I'm just lying. Finally, when my second child was born, I had my first drunk. I'm only going to tell you about my first and last drunk. But my first drunk was great. Stuart called me up, congratulated me, said, we're going out drinking tonight. I said, great. He said, I'm buying. You're going to get drunk. I said, I'll celebrate. I'm getting drunk tonight. So we got drinking. So we got to this private club. In Utah, you got to be a member of a private club to do any drinking. So we got to this private club. It's called the Winery, right across from the Salt Palace. You walk down these steps. And I had my first drunk. Walked in there, light flashing, live band. A lot of women. God, it was great. And I just drank whatever they... I don't know what I drank. A lot of people know their first drink. I don't know. They bring a drink over. It's dark. Dark drink. Got a cherry in it. I drink it down. Next drink, somebody buys me a next... It's light. Light-colored drink. Got a twist around it. I just drink it down. Some guy bought me a drink, had salt around it. Damnest thing I ever saw. Just drink it down. Whatever they buy, I'm just drinking whatever they buy. Dance. Oh, I can dance. You get a few drinks and I can dance. Dance with two lesbians. Because they're out there dancing together, you know. And I thought, they probably want me to join them. So I went out, and then they left together, and there I was alone, you know. I learned something. No rejection. When you're drunk, you're just drunk. You're not rejected, you're just drunk. Sat down, drank that next drink in front of me, got up the next morning, no hangover. Really felt pretty good. I called up Stuart. I said, Stuart, I had a ball. He said, you did. You flat got after that. I said, you think you're going to have a drink tonight? He said, I don't know. I hadn't thought about it. I'm probably going to stop on the way home, have one. I said, what time? He said, I got to work till 3 o'clock. I said, why don't we meet at 3:30? Meet at 3:30, got drunk again. That's what I do. I get drunk. I never drank socially. I never got that, you know, that cocktail or that glass of wine and had a little sip. Visited. You know? Ice melts. My ice never melted. It never melted. I never did that. I like to drink to get drunk. In fact, 3 weeks after that first drunk, I remember pulling up in front of the liquor store at 10 in the morning. Because they open at 10, so I'm on time. I get there. I go in there, I buy 3 little mini bottles of vodka. Those little mini bottles you get on the airplane, because they told me you can't smell vodka, right? So I buy those 3 little mini bottles of vodka. I suck those down as quick as I can. That's hard. Hold one of that big in those little bottles. Yeah. You'll get a hernia sucking on those puppies. You really will, you know. And I'd be okay to go to work, you know. And I'm getting in trouble. My life's changing immediately. I'm getting all kinds. People are starting to tell me, your drink is out of control. And right at that time, the mothers were really getting mad about drunk drivers. And they were getting organized. And they were publishing a lot of articles in the newspaper. I read this one article in the newspaper, and it said only 1 in 2,000 drunk drivers get picked up DWI. I read that, and I thought, that's pretty good odds. If I get drunk every single night, I've got like 5-6 years before I need to worry about getting my first DWI. You know? I've been drinking 6 months to get popped my first DWI. I'm like, what are the odds of that? It's bad, bad time. But then I thought, that's okay. I got like, this means I've got 12, 13 years before I got to worry about my next DWI, you know? But my life's changing. People are telling me my drink is, they tell me I'm an alcoholic. And I want to tell you, I hate that. When they start telling you you're an alcoholic, you have no correct response to that accusation. There's no, because you say, am not. They say, see, denial. That's the first clue. Alcoholism is denial. They got a pamphlet called denial, you know. You can't say, yeah, you're probably right, because then hell, you got to go to AA. So there's no, there's just, they say, you're an alcoholic. I say, well, what's an alcoholic? How do you really know you're alcoholic? What's an alcoholic? They say, don't get excited, it's a disease. Okay, let's go to the doctor, get a proper diagnosis. We really can't do that. Well, how do you know you're an alcoholic? Can't we go get some blood analysis? No? Well, how do you know you're an alcoholic? What's an alcoholic? Can't we go get like a CAT scan? No? Can't do that. Well, how do you know you're alcoholic? Oh, yeah, here's the deal. Y'all want me to quit drinking. Okay, what happens? 20 years from now, I find out I'm not alcoholic. I've blown 20 years. I could have been drinking. Not willing to take that kind of risk. Just not going to do it. Not going to do it. So they finally say, well, you drink too much. As soon as they tell me I drank too much, I know I'm not alcoholic. Because I never drank too much in my life. There's not an alcoholic in this room that ever drank too much. It's impossible. See, I am an alcoholic, but not because I drank too much. I'm an alcoholic because I couldn't drink enough. You ever drink enough? No. Yeah. Thank you, somebody from this room. You know, you go to the bar, you have a couple cocktails. Bartender says, "You care for another cocktail?" Oh, golly. Whew. Let's see. It's Saturday. Tomorrow's Sunday. Don't want to be late for church. I think I've had enough. Never had enough. I mean, I go to the bar at noon. You ever do that? You go to the bar at noon? Okay? Now it's midnight. You've been drinking in the same damn bar for 12 hours, right? And I'm drunk. I know I'm talking about it. Whew. God, Stuart, I am drunk. He says, me too. Can I buy another drink? Hadn't had enough. Well, if you can't drink enough, it's impossible to drink too much. What happens? See, normal drinkers, y'all know who you are. See, those normal drinkers can drink enough. And so occasionally, but not very often, they might drink too much. But if you're an alcoholic, like I'm an alcoholic, you can't drink enough, you never drink too much. Won't happen. Won't happen. So they give you that little test to take. You know, those 20 questions. I want to tell you, I can take that test. I can pass it non-alcoholic. I did it 3 times. Because I lie. Okay? I just lie. But I got a lot of problems going on. Finally, figured out my real problem. Okay, Utah, high altitude. Y'all see those Winter Olympics a couple years ago? It's up in the mountains. It's high altitude. Well, scientific known fact, people who live at high altitudes for prolonged periods of time actually have thinner blood than people that live at low altitudes. Well, you know, if you go out and party hard on thin blood, you have a problem. What I need to do is get to sea level. Okay? thicken up my blood a little bit, I'm going to be okay. I called a buddy who lives in Seattle, that sea level, telling him about these problems I got. He said, man, get away from there. Come up here. Put your life back together. I said, I don't want to impose on you and Gail, your five kids. He said, no imposition. So I'll be there Tuesday. So I moved to Seattle, you know. Wasn't doing anything in Seattle, just doing a little drinking, working on thickening up my blood. And when you're in that condition, the next logical thing you want to do, hell, you're going to want to gamble. Best time to gamble is when you're unemployed, you know. So I started playing poker up there. It was legal. And I thought, who am I kidding? I was running down to Nevada playing the casinos. And I thought, I might as well just move to Nevada. That's lower than sea level. You get thick blood in Nevada. So I ran down to Nevada, ran around Las Vegas, ended up in Reno, Tahoe area because it was cooler up there. And wasn't doing anything, just playing a little poker, doing a little drinking, working on thickening up my blood. An old drinking buddy invited me to come back to Salt Lake. Shouldn't have gone. Doing real good in Reno. So I go back to Salt Lake. Met him at the One More Time Club. It's a great club. And I found her. She's at the bar waiting. They're always sitting at the bar waiting for me. I found her. Fell in love. And I want to take her out on Saturday. She couldn't go out Saturday or Sunday. Had to stay till Monday. Supposed to go home Sunday. Should have gone home Sunday. But I stayed till Monday to go on this date. It was a bad date. Terrible. You know you got a bad date when you invite them to dinner and then they really want to eat. You know? Well, she's eating and I'm drinking, right? Well, I'm a gentleman, so every time I order a whiskey, I order a glass of wine. Well, the woman's busy eating, she ain't keeping up. Her wine's stacking up. You know? Now, to keep from being embarrassed, I drink my whiskey and drink her wine. It was just a bad date. And finally, she said, take me home. And I want to take her home. She had no fun that night at all. So I took her home, dropped her off, went over prices. It was 10:30. That Monday, by the way, was October 6, 1981. So now, tomorrow night, Tuesday, October 7, 1981, I'm going to hit this town one more time, then we got to get out of here. High altitude drink is going to get me in trouble. So we got Tuesday, October 7, 1981. Started at a little place, Joker Club. The Joker Club was not a private club. It was just a little beer bar. I'll be honest about it. It was a topless joint. Wasn't a very fancy topless joint. Joker Club had one dancer in the whole place. One dancer. It had to be drunk to appreciate her. I mean, it was just a bad thing. So we decided to go over and see the fashion show at the Hilton. I remember the fashion show and I blacked out. I black out a lot. I black out all the time. I used to say I black out every time I drink, but how do you know? I just blacked out. But I blacked out. And some blackouts are real scary. Some aren't too bad. Now, there are two factors that determine how scary a blackout is. The first factor is how long are you blacked out. Okay, the longer you're blacked out, the more scary they are. Okay. The second one is, what are you doing when you come out of your blackout? That can determine how scary that blackout is. Well, I wasn't blacked out that long, but I came out of my blackout at the worst time, without a doubt. Those of you blackout know that the worst time to come out of a blackout is when you're talking to the cops. Because you have no idea where you are in the conversation, you know? And you can't ask. You can't say, what are we doing here? You can't say that. You know? So you kind of got to figure out what do they want, what have I already admitted to, what have I given them, you know, without asking. And it's a very difficult time. And I finally figured out they wanted my driver's license. Okay? Well, I didn't have a driver's license. They'd taken that 3 DWIs earlier, you know. So I'm telling the cop, listen, I'm glad you stopped, but I'm going to leave my car parked right here. I'm going to leave it parked right here. I'm going over there. That's where I'm going to go. In fact, I'll bet you that's where my driver's license is. I'm going to go over there and get it. I'll come back and get it tomorrow. No problem. They would not let me go. Would not let me go. Finally ran my license plate, found out who it was, arrested me. See, this is not fair. This is not fair at all. Because they got these things now. I don't know if they got them up here. But they got these things and they put them on computers. And then now it's really, they put these computers in the cop car. And these things are called warrants. Okay. Once they put those warrants out, they stay on the computer a long time. Long time. They didn't bother to come look for us anymore. They just put out a warrant, wait for us to show up, you know. So I got this warrant. So I'm in jail. I'm in lockup. Don't like lockup. Don't like nothing about lockup. Want out. The first time I can't get out. They don't let me bond out. See, I knew the system. No matter what you get arrested for, you plead not guilty, right? Not guilty. And then you go to the OR person, you get out on your OR. If it's just drunk stuff back in the 70s, you get out on your OR. I think the biggest bond I ever posted was $50. And then you get your attorney, they set a court date, and you start that postponing process, right? Postpone, postpone, postpone. Keep postponing. What you're doing is you're hoping the cop dies. That's what you're doing, yeah? My cop never died, he always showed up. And so when the attorney tells you now, tomorrow we go to court. No more postponing. We go to court tomorrow. Be there at 10 o'clock. You want to be sure on the day before court, move. Okay? Because that's what I did. I just moved. Never went to court. I just moved. So I had all these failure to appear notices out put out on me. So I'm in lockup. They won't let me out. They said, no, you don't come back. You're going to go to court. So I don't like lockup. One out, can't get out. Finally, a buddy comes down named Stan. Stan's not an alcoholic, nothing about AA. But he had a lot of money, a lot of influence. And he said, I've talked to some friends. I can get you out. But you're in my custody. The only way they'll release you is into my custody. And the only way I'm going to do that is if you promise me you go to treatment because you're sick. You need help. I said, oh, Stan. Bless you. Man, you are so right. It's amazing. I don't know what it is, man. I go down to the bar, I get drunk, I get in all kinds of trouble. I don't want to do that. I guess I'm an alcoholic. I need help. But I can't get any in here. He says, I'll get you out. So I got out of jail. I had no intention. I didn't want to quit. I'm not going to quit. I'm just getting out of jail. And I'll do or say anything to get out of jail. Next day, I had to stay with Stan. So next day, he throws me the Yellow Pages. Says, you're going to where you want to go, but you're going to treatment. So I look in the Yellow Pages. A lot of treatment centers. I found this treatment center. I call him up and I said, I need to come in for a little treatment. Dan says, okay, do you have any insurance? No. I hadn't worked for 3.5 years. I don't have any insurance, you know. He said, well, it's $12,000. I said, hell, I don't want to stay all year. I couldn't believe it. It was very frustrating. I come to one place, they wanted $18,000. I was so frustrated. I said, honey, listen, if I had $18,000, I wouldn't need your goddamn treatment. You know? Would have solved any problem I got. Just give me the $18,000, I'll be okay. You know? Very frustrating. I finally caught this one joint. I said, I need to come in for a treatment. Gal says, okay. And I said, well, you need to know something. I don't have any insurance. She says, okay. I said, well, how much is it? And so she said, well, when you check in here, she's a salesperson, right? So she's going to give me benefits first before the price. She says, when you check in here, you get room, board, and therapy. Now, we have two kinds of therapy. We have group therapy and individual therapy by one of our registered counselors. And it's $9 a day. And when you check in here, we apply for food stamps. You credit those food stamps to the bill. And then when you work around here on these assignments, we get some state aid. We pay you $1.50 a day, which you can apply to the bill, or you could buy cigarettes with it. Cigarettes cost $1.25 a pack back then. And if you did all that, it would take it down to be about $5 a day. I couldn't believe it. I said, how long is your waiting list? So there's other places that had 12, 18,000 wanted that. They had 30 to 60 waiting lists just to get in. I said, how long is your waiting list? She said, well, we have a bed for you tonight. I don't really need to come tonight. Okay? She said, I think you ought to come tonight. Now, think about that. They got bargain rates, $9 a day, room, board, and therapy. They can't fill their bed. Okay? Now, they're high-pressuring me to get me to come in down there. I'm the consumer here. I got my rights. I said, honey, listen, you make my reservation for Saturday or just forget the whole damn deal. You know? So she made it for Saturday. I didn't drink. I hung out with Stan, didn't drink. Saturday came. I drove down there to that place, parked in that parking lot. I sat in that parking lot all day watching them, go in and out of it. In and out. I wanted to see what kind of person goes to a $9 a day jitter joint, you know? I'm watching, go in and out of it, in and out of it. Those guys going in there, you know, they look like alcoholics. I looked at that guy and said, look at that guy going. I wonder he's going there. Look at him. He's an alcoholic. You can tell looking at that guy, he belongs in there. He's an alcoholic. They didn't look like y'all look. Y'all don't look like alcoholics. Guys going in there look like alcoholics. And I wasn't an alcoholic, but it fit my budget, so I checked in. Nothing happened. I filled a whole bunch of papers Saturday. Got my room, nice place. Sunday came, I had my first exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous. Two guys from outside came in. They chaired the meeting. We had 36 of us, all men, in the lunchroom, sat around lunch tables. We sat around, and these two guys talked for a long time. Didn't listen to a word they said. Because I'm watching everybody else. I'm trying to figure out how you do AA. I'm a real chameleon. So when I go someplace, I'm going to watch how you act, how you behave, how you talk, and that's what I'm going to do. You know, I'm going to behave that way. So I'm watching everybody else. Nobody wanted to be there. They're just smoking cigarettes, drinking coffee. After these two guys got through talking, there was a discussion meeting, so they would start down the road or get to share. First guy introduced himself, said, my name's Joe B. I'm alcoholic. I'll pass. Second guy said, my name's Jim S. I'm alcoholic. I'll pass. I caught on real quick. What y'all do in AA, you give your first name, last initial, admit to the group you're alcoholic, and then pass. Okay? There's something magical about that. If you admit to the group you're alcoholic, and they just take that burden of alcoholism off your shoulders, said over there, that must be the deal. They had it written on the wall, admitted you're powerless over alcohol. So it got to me, I did it right. I said, my name is John A. I'm an alcoholic, and I'll pass. Nothing happened. Not a damn thing happened. I thought, well, I guess I'm not alcoholic. You know? Alcoholics Anonymous must be for real simple-minded people, if that's their program, you know? Now, as distorted perception that is of AA, that was my perception of Alcoholics Anonymous. It ain't for me. Not much to it. That was on Sunday. Monday came, had my meeting with Dale. Dell was my counselor, lovely lady. Talked to Dell for an hour. She wanted me to stay 2 months. I said, Dell. Okay? I've been here all weekend, okay? I've been talking to these guys. They've told me they're alcoholics. They are. I have no reason to doubt that they're alcoholics. They look like they probably are alcoholics. I don't know whether I am an alcoholic or not. I may have a little bit of alcoholism. Not a lot. But I'm too busy to stay 2 months. She said, you're busy? I said, yes, I'm too busy to stay. I can't stay 2 months. Too busy. She looks through her papers and says, well, now where were you working? Well, I'm not working, but I'm busy. Isn't that true about us? Alcoholics are the most busy, unemployed people you ever want to meet in your life. So go to the meeting Monday, right? Go to your home group Monday. You go in there, now the guy's unemployed, he's got nothing to do but get to the meeting, and he's late. And you say, where have you been? Hell, I've been busy. You know? I don't know what we do, but we're busy doing it, you know, we really are. So I said, I'll give you 2 weeks. You know, I'll give you 2 weeks, because I can, you know, I'm not gonna quit drinking, that's all I'm doing there. I'm not. You know, I'm just doing treatment time. I figure treatment time is better than jail time. That's what I'm doing. I don't tell anybody that. That's what I'm doing. So I said, I'll give you 2 weeks. So you give me whatever material you're going to study during that 2 month period, okay? I'll read it. I'll read ahead. You can give me some pop quizzes if you want. Because 2 weeks I'm out of here. She listened to all that BS and I says, well, we better hurry with you. I said, damn right, you better hurry with me. That was on Monday. Tuesday, I got to go to group. Group. Oh, I love group. Group's wonderful. Wednesday was Alcoholic Education Seminar. They're showing a movie. I don't like movies about drug addiction and alcoholism. They're boring. Even today, movies about drug addiction and alcoholism are boring, you know? So I'm sitting there prepared not to like this movie. And the name of the movie they're showing was I'll Quit Tomorrow. So I'm sitting there, all my pride, all my ego, all my contempt, prepared not to like this movie. I'm watching this movie, and it tore me up. I related to everything in that movie. I did everything that guy did. I talked the way that guy talked. I acted the way the guy acted. I dressed the way the guy dressed. I drank the way the guy drank. I related to everything in that movie. And I knew the gig was up because I related to it. That was my moment of clarity when I knew the gig was up. What happened to me that night is I quit looking for that definition. What's an alcoholic? How do you know you're an alcoholic? I later found out in AA, see, we don't have a definition of an alcoholic. I couldn't define an alcoholic for you this morning. I don't know how to define that. What we have in AA is a description. See, you can't argue with the description. You can argue with the definition. That's why Webster's got 10 definitions for every word, right? But you can't argue with the description. The most powerful tool God has given Alcoholics Anonymous is our description of the alcoholic. Because of that description, as the alcoholic relates to it, that seems to have the power to literally strip everything that separates the alcoholic from himself. And I could see me that night like I'd never seen me. I could see me that night like my mother saw me. I could see me that night like my ex-wife saw me. The difference was I could see me as I related to that. And I knew the gig was up. The most powerful tool we have is that description. Think how important that description is. Two-thirds of our book, two-thirds of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is what? Descriptions of alcoholics and the stories. I mean, why'd they put all those stories in there? Just to make a big book? You know? No, it's the description that is that important as the alcoholic relates to it that seems to have that power to strip everything that separates the alcoholic. And I wasn't happy about it. Sometimes you'll hear from the podium, people will say how relieved they were when they discovered they're alcoholics and how at home they felt. That was not my experience. I was pissed, okay? And I was scared to death. I mean, my God, my whole life just changed. My whole life's just, I'm an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic. I mean, I got to go, like, get a job. You know? Everything's changed now. I can't drink. I'm an alcoholic. I cried all night. And I stayed there 6 weeks. And I couldn't stay 2 months, too busy. You know? But when I got out of there, they told me that now a very important part of treatment is aftercare. You need aftercare. But you're living in Reno, we're in Salt Lake, that's 800 miles, you can't come back 3 times a week. So we're going to prescribe that you go to AA for your aftercare. And they gave me Intergroup's phone number, Reno, Nevada. So I drove back to Reno. I know two things when I got back to Reno. I know I'm an alcoholic, I don't want to drink. I know that. And the second thing was, AA's got nothing to offer. I mean, come on, man. You go there, you give your first name, last initial, admit you're alcoholic, and then pass, okay? A little Mickey Mouse program. I don't know why we got to keep doing that time after time after time. So, but I don't want to drink. I don't want to drink if I know I'm an alcoholic. So the first day I'm back in town, I call AA. Guy answered the phone. I said, my name is John A., and I'm an alcoholic. And the guy said, well, I'm Bruce. I'm an alcoholic, John. What can I do for you? And I said, well, listen, I just got out of treatment, you know, in Salt Lake City. I'm living here in Reno, Nevada, and I wanted to call and report in. You know? I thought they had me on a computer, you know. And if you don't report it, they put out a failure to appear on you. I'm screwed. So he said, well, I'm glad you're here. He said, do you want to go to a meeting tonight? It was Thursday night. You want to go to a meeting? I said, yeah, I'll go to a meeting. You'll probably want to meet me. He said, I'm not going. But there's a men's stag, the whole Riverside Casino, third floor Sierra room, starts at 8:30. I said, well, I know right where that is. I'll be there early so we can meet. He said, I'm not going. And I said, well, you know, at least call them, you know, and tell them that John A. is coming to their meeting tonight. He said, don't worry about it, they'll be there. So I show up 20 after 8, first resentment in Alcoholics Anonymous. I called, made my reservations. Guy did not call and follow through on that. Nobody there said, oh, you must be John A. We got your reservation here. Here's your chair, coffee, what do you need? No, just some guys smoking cigarettes, drinking coffee, waiting for the meeting. Pretty soon, a guy named Red got to chair of the meeting. Red looked like an alcoholic. He only had 18 years. And he talked for a long time, didn't listen to a word Red said, because I'm busy watching everybody else. How do they do AA in Reno? They were doing it just like they did in treatment. Smoke cigarettes, drink coffee. Didn't pay a bit of attention to Red. Fred got through talking. They started down the row. It was a discussion meeting. We're going to share. These guys did not pass. They were talking. Now, I have no idea what they were talking about. Nothing we talked about in treatment. But you know what? They couldn't even introduce themselves right. Some of them did not give their last initial. They said, "My name is John. I'm an alcoholic." You're supposed to give your last initial. Yeah. Guy didn't give his last initial. Supposed to do that. Some of them gave their last name. They said, "My name is John Allred. I'm an alcoholic." But Jesus. What does he think anonymous means, man? It's amazing. So I thought, you know what? If he's not going to respect his own anonymity, I will. I won't look at the guy. I won't look at the guy. Don't know who you are. Don't know who you are. If I see you, I won't say hi if I see you on the street. It's an anonymous program. We stay anonymous around here. So they're talking. I don't know what they're talking about. I mean, I sat halfway through that meeting. Nobody mentioned we got an XY chromosome deficiency. It became real clear to me, these guys have not been to treatment. So it got to me. I thought I'd help. I said, "My name is John A., and I'm an alcoholic." And then I qualified. I said, "Listen, guys, I just got out of treatment over here in Salt Lake City. I want you all to know I have the latest, most up-to-date medical and psychological information on the disease outcome." Second resentment, Red cut me off, said, "Thank you, John. We're on the next guy." I thought, son of a bitch is jealous. I know stuff he don't know. Yeah. Asked me, some guys came up and shook my hand. They said, "We hope you come back." Said, "Hell, I'll be back. They need me down there. They need me." Now, Chuck Chamberlain used to always say, "Remember, my teacher. Some people teach me what to do. Some people teach me what not to do." Right? Please keep in mind, if you're new, most of what I share from the podium is what not to do. Okay? Because I've done this deal all wrong. I totally don't do it very good. I don't know where I was when I said 90 meetings in 90 days. That's not the way I did it. I did one meeting a week. Every Thursday, I got on my men's staff. Now, they will not let me share. But I keep going back. I figure I'm a hell of a lot younger than Red. He's going to die, then I get to share. Now, let me tell you what happens when you go to one meeting a week if you haven't tried that program. One of the things they told me in treatment, which is true, they said, "John, don't drink." Okay, if you just don't drink, you'll feel better. That's true. But see, nobody explained to me what that meant. If you don't drink, you'll feel better. You're going to feel everything better. You're going to feel all the pain, all the anger. All the, you're going to feel that shit a whole lot better. You know? So I'm walking around Reno feeling better, going nuts. I mean, that's why I drink. I drink when I feel better, you know. I don't want to feel that stuff. So I'm down at my meeting Thursday night. It was Christmas Eve that Thursday at my men's stag meeting. And they said, "Okay, now tomorrow's Christmas Day. Those of you got nowhere to go for Christmas, you go to the Dryers Club. Skid Row Clubhouse in Reno on Wells Street. Still there. You go to the Dryers Club on Wells. Free Christmas dinner. They're cooking it." So I had nowhere to go at Christmas, so I went over to the Dryers Club. I found it, went in, it was good, I ate. I'm sitting, I'm not doing anything, I'm just drinking a cup of coffee, smoking a cigarette. The guy spotted me. You know those old timers, they spot a newcomer, you can tell. When they spot a newcomer, their eyes kind of glaze over. Right? And they start to salivate. Newcomer. I saw him, he looked at me, I saw his eyes glazing. He started walking over. I said, "Look at this guy coming over here. He's not my kind of guy. I like cool guys, ain't nothing cool about him at all. The old guy. A fat old guy. Funny hair, big nose, nothing cool at all. Not my kind of guy." You know, I said, look at this guy coming over here to talk to me. Can you believe this? Look at this guy. He comes over, introduces himself. His name's Don. He's a coordinator of intergroup. Don't know what that is, but I thought, you know what? I'm glad they found something for you to do, Don. Mm-hmm. So I talked to Don for a while. It became clear after talking to Don for just a few minutes, Don had not been to treatment. You know? So I start telling Don about all the stuff they not let me talk about in my home group. He gets a funny look on his face and he says, "Would you like to go to a meeting with me tonight?" And I said, "Well, hell, Don, it's Friday. I go Thursdays." Men staggered. He said, "We got a meeting every night in Reno. And then in that 3 weeks I've been going to AA, I'd heard something about spiritual program. This is a spiritual program." They heard that. And I thought, okay, it's a spiritual program. It's Christmas. I can go twice this week, won't hurt, you know. So Don comes and gets me. We go out to the state hospital. We got a meeting at 7 o'clock out there at the state hospital. Walk in there. I love that meeting because they give you a raffle ticket when you walk in. And at the end of the meeting, they raffle off a big book or as Bill sees it. So I get my raffle ticket, walk in the meeting. They got women in that meeting. First meeting I've been to with women, and I didn't know that other men. I thought it was a man's deal. You know, I've been to men's drought joint, men's stag meeting, got women in the meeting. Immediately adopt that as my home group. Why am I going Thursdays when I come here Friday with women, you know? This is my new home group, baby. So they got, I don't know what they talked about, they had some meeting, because I'm busy praying, okay? Because I got this raffle, and I don't have a good mind, and I read real fast. I had forgot to get a big book. Now, this is it, man. I'm winning the book. I'm probably the only guy in this meeting without a book. I'm winning the book tonight. It's Christmas. This is going to be God's gift to me on Christmas. The only Christmas gift I'm going to get is going to be this book. I'm winning the book. I prayed hard. I want that book. Then in the meeting, that book is mine. Nobody's been praying like I've been praying for the book. I want the book. So at the end of the meeting, they had the raffle. Raffle off the big book. Third of resentment in Alcoholics Anonymous. Some gray-haired lady, 25 years sober, wins my book. I thought, what's she doing winning my book? She got five of my home. She's so old, can't even read anymore. She's to read this and win my book. So I'm storming out. Before I can get out of there, that little lady comes up and gives me that book. That's where I got my book. I took that book home. I used to say that I took the book home that night and I read it from cover to cover. So if you ever heard me say that, or if you ever get hold of a really old tape, or I said that on the tape, okay, please believe me that when I said that, hell, I believed it. You know? Then I got involved in a big book study. You wouldn't believe the chapters they got in that book. They got a chapter in the book, chapter to the wives. Well, I wasn't a wife, didn't have a wife, didn't want a wife. Didn't read that chapter. Okay? We've got a chapter in the book, chapter to the employer. I'm not even an employee. Didn't read that chapter. Okay? We've got a chapter in the book, chapter to the agnostic. We agnostic. I'm not agnostic. I know God rules. Didn't read that chapter. Okay? Well, I want to tell you, if you just read, you know, chapter 3 and chapter 5, if you can read that night, it won't take you long to do it. It really won't. The next day, this guy called me on the phone, takes me to another meeting. Every day, Don has called me every day, taking me to a meeting. And I don't really want to go. But he doesn't ask. He just calls up and says, "Pick up in 20 minutes. Quit." I go. Well, how does he know I want to go to a meeting? I don't want to go to that meeting. But then I think, wait a minute. You know, he's the only guy talking to me in AA. If I don't go, he's going to talk behind my back. He's going to ridicule me behind me. I got to go. Got to go defend myself. And a fascinating thing happened to me. Now, at that time, I didn't have a sponsor. Hadn't worked any steps. Nothing had changed except one thing. The only change in my life is I'm going to a meeting every single day. And a fascinating thing happened. I not only feel better, but I feel good. And I hadn't felt those two things at the same time in years. And all of a sudden, sobriety started putting on flesh and bones, you know? And I started getting excited about it. I started hanging out in inner group, drinking coffee with Don, meeting other alcoholics, going to meetings at night. And it was exciting, and it was embarrassing, too. I mean, I felt like a little kid. Don would come get me. I'd get in his car. We're going to the meeting. I'd say, "Don, do you think we can go get ice cream tonight?" "We'll see." Yeah. Well, it's fascinating. So I'm hanging out in a group during the day. I'm down there a week later. It was Thursday, New Year's Eve, Thursday. Week later, New Year's Eve on Thursday. I'm going to my men's stag meeting Thursday night. I'm an intergroup. The phone rings intergroup. I grab the phone. I'm fired up, man. I grab that phone. This young kid named Glenn. Now, Glenn's 17 years old, wants to know how to stay sober New Year's Eve. I said, why? I mean, damn, Glenn, you're 17. It's New Year's Eve, okay? Call tomorrow. We're going to be open tomorrow. No big deal, you know? Fourth resentment. Don grabbed that phone away from me, you know? That's when he passed the rule at Central Office. You have to have 6 months or more sobriety to answer the phone. He put a big sign above the phone. Must have 6 months to answer a phone, you know? Don talked to him for a while, gave him his phone number, and not give me my phone number. But the next day, Don calls me and said, hey, Glenn stays sober, wants to go to a meeting. I'm like, great, 12-step work. So Don comes, gets me. We go get Glenn. Well, we're out of state hospital. And we're driving the car, my first 12-step call. I'm excited. And you know what? Damn it. Don's just driving the car. He's not preparing Glenn for AA. And I thought, hell, I got to do it all. I just got to do it all here, you know? So I start telling Glenn all about it. I said, Glenn, you're going to love this, man. You get women your first meeting. Okay, there are women here. I didn't know they were there for months, but you get women right out of the street. I'm going to tell you, Glenn, I've been to a couple other groups in the Reno area here, and this group has the best-looking women. You want to come back here with me next Friday. This is going to be great. And then when we get there, they're going to give you a raffle ticket. Hang on to the raffle ticket, because at the end of the meeting, they're going to raffle off the big book, or as Bill sees it. And if God loves you, you'll win that book. Don doesn't say where Don just drives to the meeting. So we get to the meeting. I don't know what they talk about, because I'm busy praying for Glenn. I thought, come on, God, let Glenn win that book. If Glenn can just win that book after I've prepared him like I have, he'll stay sober forever. And not that it matters, but, you know, I would have 100% 12-step call success rate. I'll be able to write articles in the grapevine, how to have 100% 12-step call success rate. You know, it'd be great. Only guy in AA with 100% 12-step call success rate. So I'm praying for Glenn. At the end of the meeting, they went to have the raffle off the big book at the end of that meeting. I won the book. Don turned to me and said, see how that works? I said, yeah. I signed it and gave it to Glenn. That's where Glenn got his book. Okay? And Glenn's sober today because I gave him that book. That's why I sold it. Now, that little experience early in my sobriety taught me a lot. Because it taught me how God works. See? God works through people. Okay? See, whenever God works, it's a win-win situation. Always two winners when God works. It's a win-win deal with God. Always two winners when God works. So I could have won the big book the first night, there would have been one winner, me. But that little lady won by being able to share with me, and I won by being able to receive from her. Two winners. Week later, two winners. I won by being able to share with Glenn, and Glenn won by being able to receive from me. God works through people. It's always a win-win deal. He works through people. See, by working through people, he gets twice the results for the same effort. Very efficient God. You know? God works. It also taught me how Alcoholics Anonymous works. Alcoholics Anonymous is one drunk sharing with another. And that's the magic to our deal, guys. When that happens, it's unbelievable. When one drunk shares with another. See, I've told that story, it's the only story I've got, maybe 1,000 times in almost 24 years. And every time I tell that story, I remember that moment of clarity when I knew the gig was up. I'm convinced that all of us here tonight that are sober in Alcoholics Anonymous have had that moment of clarity when you knew the gig was up. I'm equally convinced that those that come to AA for a while and leave and are out there drinking and dying tonight had that moment of clarity when they knew it was over. What's the difference between those of us that are sober here today and those of us that have come and left and are out there drinking tonight? We both had that moment of clarity. I think what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous is really pretty simple. What we do in here is we keep that moment alive. We keep it alive. Because I've shared my moment with you of what it was like and what happened. As I've shared my moment with you of what it was like and what happened. What have you thought about? And when one of you is on this side of the podium and I'm on that side of the podium, and you're sharing what it was like, what happened and what it was like, and you're keeping your moment alive. By the way, isn't this the perfect program for people whose root problem is we're selfish, self-centered? Think about that. Because when you're appearing, you're remembering your moment. I'm so self-centered, what am I thinking about? My moment, screw your deal. You know? We keep it alive. And nowhere can you keep that moment alive but when one alcoholic shares with another. It's only a win-win deal when that happens. You can't keep your moment alive by sharing with your doctor. Your doctor doesn't need to hear it. It's not a win-win deal. I need to hear it. My very life depends on hearing about your moment so that my moment stays alive. You can't keep your moment alive by sharing with your therapist. Not a win-win deal. They don't need to hear it. I need to hear about your moment so that my moment stays alive. We keep that moment alive. Because what happens when you lose your moment? You take drunk. Because it's that moment of clarity that is God's gift. That's what happens. That's God's gift. And that usually happens before you get to AA. We assume you've had that when you show up here. And the proof of that statement is your last drink. I'm willing to bet a whole lot of money. When you took your last drink and you sat it down, you had no idea that was your last drink. You know? I mean, I didn't. Hell, if I would have, I'd have done it different. You know? What happened? What happened? We call it divine intervention. Something happened. We don't know what it is. We don't know what happens in here. But it always happens. We have that moment of clarity and we get that reprieve for that day. And what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous is we keep that moment alive. I've had it. My experience in Alcoholics Anonymous has been incredible. You know, it's just been an incredible experience. I'm living in Reno, Nevada. I'm working to set up with my sponsor, Don. And I got a Christmas card from my sister. I call her. She lives in Dallas. So I call her. I'm talking to her in Dallas. She invited me to come to Dallas. I didn't really want to take a sober geographic. I was doing pretty good in Reno. I had a little job, doing pretty good. And I was making $4 an hour. And she sent me this classified ad section from Dallas. This is 1982. That was a big, thick paper. Just the classified ad section was bigger than our whole paper in Reno. And but I didn't want to take a sober geographic. I talked to my sponsor. I said, she's inviting me to come to Dallas. I don't want to take a sober geographic. Don't know whether I'd go or not. He said, well, let me ask you a question. He said, you want to go? You got somebody down there you want to go see? I said, no, I don't really want to do that. He said, you need to go. You need to get out of town. I said, no, I don't need to get out of town. There's no heat on me here. He said, you have to go? You have a girlfriend that is making you go down there? I said, no, I don't have to go. He said, well, if you don't want to go, and if you don't need to go, and if you don't have to go, hell, then you can go. And that's really true. If you run that test on any time you move, you'll never have to take a sober geographic. And so I moved to Dallas in 1983. And I moved by UPS. I'd sold my car for $500, and I boxed everything I owned up into three boxes. And I called UPS. They picked them up, and they shipped them to my sister. And then I hitchhiked from Reno, Nevada to Salt Lake City, Utah, because you could fly for $99 one way from Salt Lake to Dallas. And so I flew for $99 to Dallas, Texas, and I landed in Dallas February 1 of 1983. And I've been there ever since. And I got a sponsor in Dallas. My whole life came together real quick in Dallas. Real quick. I got back in the insurance business in Dallas. I got married in Dallas. Got divorced in Dallas. And that was an interesting experience. I found out, it's an interesting thing about it going through all that, because that wasn't part of the plan. And I found out that you cannot do divorce right in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because no matter what you do, a third of the group will be mad at you. Just figure that out. A third of the group's going to be mad at you if you get divorced. Because you get divorced, and so you'll say, okay, I'm not going to do anything. I'm just going to hang out here. I'm going to work on myself and try to get well. And so a third of the group will say after a few weeks, they'll say, oh, look at John. He's isolating. He's isolated. This is no good. This is no good for him. He needs to get out. He needs to accept that divorce and get on with his life. He's isolating over there. So you say, okay, I'm going to start to date. So you start dating somebody, and they'll say, oh, look at this guy. He's rebounding, man. Guy's rebounding here. He's getting involved way too soon. Shouldn't get involved way too soon. Don't want to do that. So you say, okay, I'm going to date a bunch of people. So a third group says, oh, look at that. Look at him. He's screwing the whole group. He's going through the whole group. He's going through the whole group. It's out of control. So there's nothing you can do that's going to be right. Just assume that you'll be okay. And so I'm going through that divorce. It's very painful. Very painful. And it would hit me in waves, you know? And they told me, they said, now, when all else fails, you need to work with another alcoholic. So I started going to a lot of newcomers' meetings. I'd pass my business out to a lot of newcomers, you know? And the problem is, when you do that, they start to call you. You know? So I started sponsoring all these guys coming out of these treatment centers. This was, like, 89. And, so I'm sponsoring all these new guys coming out of these treatment centers. And they had a lot of stuff that was new to me that they got involved in. And I was totally unaware of that. I mean, I'd call them. They'd call me on the phone and they'd say, if you're going to help me, John, you need to, we need to get together and discuss some of my core issues. I didn't know what a core issue was. I'd say, I don't know what you're talking about. He said, well, I know, we need to explain this. See, I come from a very dysfunctional family. And because of that, you know, I never had any proper role models to learn how I should set proper boundaries. And which, quite frankly, I have some abandonment issues, which really have brought on a lot of sex problems that just are driving me nuts, you know. I'm listening to that. I'm exhausted. We've only been talking on the phone for 5 minutes. I'm exhausted. I guess we need to get together, you know. So they come over to the house, you know, and they bring all these books with them. These new books they got out of these jitter joints, and they bring these books over there that I'm supposed to help them, and they're all on their latest antidepressant, and it's helping them, and I'm no doctor, you know, so they give me all this. I'm going to tell you, they give you all those books to read. Let me tell you, you want to get involved in that stuff and read those books, let me tell you what will happen to you. You'll relate. And I'll tell you why you'll relate. What they've done very conveniently is they've taken all of our character defects and they've compartmentalized them, you know, and made them, some call them issues, you know. It's a fascinating thing. And I know, I was in the insurance business when they did that. Let me tell you why they did that. The treatment centers were treating us, and we weren't getting any better. And they were putting out, got it to be like $40,000 a month for treatment. You get $30,000, $40,000 a month for treatment. Pretty soon they put out $250,000 on us, and we're still getting drunk. And so they ran some surveys, and they found out that the same percentage of people that go to AA stay sober as those that go to treatment and then go to AA. Percentage was the same. So they said, you know what? We're not going to pay for this treatment. We're going to deem alcoholism as a mental disorder. Disorders became the new word. So all those character defects are now disorders. And they said, so we're going to pay $5,000 for mental disorder, lifetime benefit, period. And they said, $5,000, we can't get you well for $5,000. So they said, that's all we're going to pay for that disorder. They said, okay, $5,000 for alcoholism. Let me ask you a question. Will y'all pay us $5,000 for depression? Oh yeah, you'll pay $5,000 for depression. That's a good disorder. Will y'all pay us $5,000 for anxiety disorder? Oh yeah, we'll pay you $5,000 for anxiety disorder. So all of a sudden they started piling on all of these disorders that we all have. We call them, you know, defects. They pile on all these disorders and pretty soon they got their money back. That's how that all came about, you know. And the proof of that statement is, I want to promise you, think about it, if you've been to treatment in the last 10 years, when you got out of treatment, you had more than one thing wrong with you, didn't you? Because they can't treat you if you only got one thing wrong. You got to have a lot wrong with you. And the thing is, we do. We do. Alcoholism is very complicated. And there's a ton wrong with us. We got all that crap. We got all of it. And it's all the same disease. Alcoholism. You depressed? Yeah, I want to tell you, if you drink a depressant for 20 years, you'd probably be depressed. Okay. So I'm sitting there and they're going through all this stuff and I don't know what they're doing. I'm totally unprepared for all this stuff, but they're going to all this stuff and they're not getting well, they're getting drunk and I'm working, I'm getting sick, I'm not getting any relief. I go to my sponsor's house and I'm complaining to him. I said, you know what? I've done everything you sons of bitches told me to do. I'm not getting any well. My program is not working. My program is not working. And he looked at me and he said, well, why don't you try ours? And then he asked me some key questions. He said, John, just let me ask you something. How many people under a year are you sponsoring? I said, 14. He said, any of them getting well? I said, no. And I'm getting sick. And he said, well, let me ask you, are you passing on to them the same simple program of AA that was passed on to you? And I wasn't. And I had to go to those guys and make amends, knowing that most of them would leave and go find other sponsors, and maybe they'd get well, you know? Because I was not passing on in the same program that then was passed on to me. And I don't want anybody to leave today, after you've been so nice to invite me up here, and not know the program of AA that was passed on to me. Because that's what I'm responsible for. To pass on the program that was passed on to me. And when I sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know how hard this is for the old-timers, to sit in there and they're off on a tangent talking about their anger management and what their sponsor has them doing or their counselor has them doing for anger management and all this other stuff that they're into. You know, and you feel like, where am I? You know? And when you try to say something about it, they all jump down your neck and they say, you know, Bill Wilson wouldn't do that. You know? I don't know how hard that is. But I don't want anybody to leave and not know the program that's passed on to me because your life depends on that. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the program of AA that was passed on to me doesn't say a damn thing about dealing with any issues. Nothing about it. In fact, it says just the opposite. It says, John, you can't do it. If you could have dealt with those things, you'd have done it 25 years ago. I can't deal with that stuff. I don't know how to deal with my anger. I don't call my sponsor to learn how to manage my life better. That's not what I do. My sponsor's not the fire chief. That's there to put out fires that I start. AA is not a fire station where they come running in there with their hair on fire saying, what am I going to do? I've done this, I've done that. That's not what we do in AA. AA is a program that has a lifestyle that works. It's a lifestyle that works. It really works. We teach you how to not start the fire. You know, that's what we do in AA. We find out in AA that I am powerless. I do not have the power to be anything other than what I am. I'm a liar. And I can't be anything but a liar. So I'm going to have to find me a power greater than myself that will solve my problem. That's what we do in AA. It's a spiritual plan. I'm going to find a power. I'm beyond human help. I'm beyond that. If human help would have helped me, it would have done it. Never did me any good. Got me all kinds of hot water. I'm beyond human help. I need to find a power greater than myself that's going to solve my problem. I call my sponsor to learn how to surrender my life, not manage it. And there's a big difference between surrendering your life to a power greater than yourself and managing your life. And it all has to do with honesty. It all has to do with being totally honest. I got guys coming over to ask me, they say, you know, here's what I've done. What am I going to tell her? Oh, how about the truth? God, she'll leave. Yeah, hopefully. You know? Well, how can I phrase that so she doesn't leave? You can. You know? We're going to be honest about it and let the chips fall where they might. What am I going to tell my boss? Oh, probably the truth. He'll fire me. Yeah, probably. You know? But God is going to take care of us. Now, all that applies, only this congregation or something, this AA deal only applies if you really believe in God. If you believe that God loves you and God is going to take care of you. Do you really believe that? Or is that just AA podium rhetoric? Is that just stuff we talk about to make each other feel better? You know, maybe this whole thing is just a coincidence. You know, that Bill and Bob got together here 70 years ago. And this whole thing worked out. And that now millions of us have got so it's just a coincidence. You know, it's like I'm sitting in my home group. Sitting in my home group. I'm only 2 years sober. Dallas North, my home group. I'm sitting down there 2 years sober. Getting ready. It was birthday night. 200 people at that big group. 200 people there celebrate birthday night. After the party, I'm leaving to go home. Joanne's working the front desk. Joanne comes up to me, grabs me. And she says, hey, this little guy called from San Antonio. Her mother called. This woman called from San Antonio. And her son's here in Dallas drunk. And he's suicidal. He's going to kill himself. She called him off. She can't get up here quick enough to save him. You want to make this 12-step call? And I said, not if he's got a gun, you know. And I said, give me the phone number. Let me call her. So I called her on the phone down in San Antonio. Little lady answered the phone crying. She said, my son called me. And he's drunk in Dallas. Been drunk for a long time, and he's real disoriented. He drinks and drugs when he's out there. Disoriented, and he couldn't find AA's phone number. But he could remember his mama's phone number. He called his mama and asked her to call AA in Dallas to help him. Because she said, he's suicidal, going to kill him. Can you help my son? I said, let me call him. So she gave me his phone number. I called him on the phone, told him who it was, and said, you want some help? He said, yeah, I want some help. And I said, well, where are you? We'll come see you. And he said, man, I can't tell you where I am. So I've been drinking a drug and I haven't been to bed in 2 weeks. He said, I'm disoriented. I can't even tell you how to get here. He said, just give me your address. We'll find you. He said, it won't work, man. It's a brand new street. It's not even in Mapsco. You never find it. I'm too messed up to tell you, give you directions. I said, give me your damn phone number or your address. I'll find you. So I gave him his address. He lived on Dome Street. Now, I've told this story for 20 years, 22 years, every month in Dallas, Texas, I do the steps. And I tell this story. That's thousands of drunks all around every group in Dallas-Fort Worth area. I've told this story to for 22 years. And I always ask, does anybody know where Dome Street is? That's thousands of people in Dallas, Texas to live there. I've asked. Nobody knows where Dome Street is. It's only a street 2 blocks long. Very hard to find. But see, I know where Dome Street is. I know right. I have a client that lives on Dome Street. He not only lives on Dome Street, he is literally the next door neighbor, the guy making the phone call. I said, oh, I know that address. I know right where you are. I'll be there in 20 minutes. Got the guy sponsoring me to make that toast. And that's just a coincidence, isn't it? God ain't going to do that. You know the odds of that? The odds of a lady in San Antonio calling directory information, asking for AA. We got like 150 groups in Dallas. For some reason, an operator picks Dallas North. I'm only 2 years sober. 200 people at the meeting, but Joanne picks me to give that 12-step call to, and I know where Dome Street is. You know the odds of that? I'm a gambler, right? Oh, yeah, I want to bet on that. That'll happen a lot. Just a coincidence. God ain't going to do that. God ain't going to put just the right person at just the right time with just the right information in our lives. Since God works through people, that's just a coincidence, isn't it? A little while later, I'm going out to California on a business trip. I'm at the airport. Going to leave at 9 o'clock in the morning. Big sign up there. The plane's been delayed an hour. No big deal. I get my coffee. I'm waiting an hour. They come back an hour later and they say, listen, this flight's been canceled. The plane's broke. Won't work. But there's a plane 2 gates down going to California. There's some standby room on it. So 200 of us run down there to get on standby. You know, there's only 17 seats left on that standby. I'm the second to the last guy that's been on standby. So I get on standby, I go back to that plane, There's one seat left. This is when you can smoke on airplanes. There's one seat in the smoking section, right next to the window. Right next to that is this good-looking gal in a red dress. Never forget that red dress. God has worked in my life today, you know? So I sit down. And this is a bad seat. This is a chatterbox. This guy just chatter. I have not had enough coffee for this woman. I was having another one. Finally, the plane takes off. She sets up. She pulls out a needlepoint. She's needlepointing. I look over. She's needlepointing the Serenity Prayer. My turn. So I said, what are you doing? She said, I'm needlepointing. I said, I know. What are you needlepointing? She's real embarrassed. She didn't want to show me. She said, oh, nothing. I'm just needlepointing. She said, what are you needlepointing? She finally holds up and she says, well, they call this the Serenity Prayer. I said, oh, man. Are you one of those Jesus freaks? She goes, no. Master's real nervous, you know. Her hands are sweaty. She knows I'm watching her. She said, but I'm trying to lead a spiritual life. I said, really? She says, yeah. She knew a point of going over. I thought, I better stop this poor gal before she breaks a finger. I said, honey, listen, if that's the Serenity Prayer and you're trying to lead a spiritual life, let me ask you a question. Are you a friend of Bill W.'s? And boy, she stopped and sighed and looked at me. She said, yeah. Are you? I said, no. I said, he died a long time before I got sober, you know. He just really did, you know. So, come to find out, this poor gal, that she had a couple months sober. This was her first trip away from home. And was petrified because she was scared to death. She was going to drink out of it. She'd also had her first drunk dream the night before. And she thought it was a premonition she was going to get drunk. And she's going to be out in California. Didn't know anybody out in California. She's going to be out there for 2 weeks on training for a new company. And I was just scared to death. And she said, we had a great three-hour meeting. I told her about some of my drunk dreams and what that was all about. I told her, gave her some phone numbers of people out there in California that she could call, take her to a meeting. She said, we cried. She said to me, she said, can you believe what God did? I've been trying to quit smoking. So I sit up in the non-smoking section. When they announced you guys were going to come on board, we could move seats if we wanted to. Can you believe that God would have me move back here to sit in this seat so I could sit by you? I said, hell, he canceled my whole plan to get me to come over here and sit by you. You know? That's just a coincidence, isn't it? Come on, John. God ain't going to do that. God ain't going to cancel a plan so you can make a 12-step call. Don't be ridiculous. That's just a coincidence, you know? God ain't going to put just the right person at just the right time with just the right information in our lives to help us. Since God works through people, come on, it's just a coincidence, right? 1990, I'm down in Del Rio, Texas. It's a border town. Small border town. They got a conference they used to have down there. They don't have it anymore. About 70 people in that conference. They invited me to come down there. Sure, some down there in Del Rio. And I meet this gal Saturday. On her badge, it says Dottie E. from Connecticut. And I said, Dottie, what are you doing here from Connecticut? She said, well, I'm on my way to see my husband. He's in the military. He's in the Navy. He's in San Diego in the Navy. I was driving down from Connecticut to see him. We spent the day in Del Rio. Spent last night in Del Rio. We're going to go on today, but we decided to spend the day in Del Rio. I called the AA. They told me about this conference, so I thought I'd come to it. And I said, well, great. Welcome to Texas. So I spoke Saturday night. When I get through speaking, Dottie comes up to me. She heard my story. She said, so you grew up in Utah? I said, yeah. She said, by any chance, do you have any relatives in Orem, Utah? And I said, well, I grew up in Orem, Utah. It's my hometown. She said, well, are you related to Mark and Betty Jo? I said, well, they're my parents. Dottie starts to cry. She throws her arm around me and tells me what her last name is. She said, Bobby is my husband. Tommy's my husband. She said, Tommy's my first cousin. He's 3 days older than me. We grew up together, ripping and running. Turned 18. I went to college. He joined the Navy. I'd seen Tommy one time in 18 years. Didn't know he was in AA. He had met Dottie in Alcoholics Anonymous. They got married. And she was on his way. He was in the Navy. And she was in Connecticut. He was in San Diego station. She says, I'm on my way to see Tommy because Tommy's drunk. And I'm divorcing him. We called him. He was drunk that night. She said, Tommy had a real God problem. And that cracked a little door. We were able to make some make a 12-step call on Tommy. And I know where Tommy is today. You know, and I also know Tommy got 14 years sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous today. You know? Now that's just a coincidence, isn't it? God ain't going to do that. You know the odds of that? She's in Connecticut. He's in San Diego. I'm in Dallas. And I meet this gal married to my first cousin in Del Rio. You know, because she decided to spend the day in Del Rio. Nobody spends the day in Del Rio. Okay? That's just a coincidence, isn't it? God ain't going to do that. God ain't going to put just the right person at just the right time with just the right information in our lives to help us, is he? Since God works through people. That's not the way it's going to be. It's just a coincidence, isn't it? Patsy and I were in Hawaii at the Hawaiian State Convention for Alcoholics Anonymous. And Friday morning we got up and they called and my dad had died in Salt Lake. And we couldn't get off the island. We couldn't get off till Saturday. So we got off the island on Saturday and we had to fly a weird way because all the flights were so crazy. We had to go from Hawaii to San Francisco. We had a 4.5-hour layover in San Francisco, and then we had to go clear back to Dallas, and then from Dallas down to Houston, then from Houston back to Salt Lake. It took 24 hours to get there. And we got there on Sunday afternoon. We buried my dad Monday morning. And Tuesday, I'm getting ready to leave. My son took me, who was living in Salt Lake. He dropped me off at the airport. And I had about 3 hours before the plane was going to leave. And that was really the first time I'd been alone. And so I'm sitting there in the Salt Lake City airport, and I'm lonely, and I'm real tired. I'm real tired. Hadn't slept at all. And I'm sitting there. I start into that valley where I'm lonely and tired. I'm a little angry. Wasn't all that hungry. But I'm starting into the valley. And when you go into the valley, it's dark. And it's scary. And there's a sense of impending doom. And I start to beat myself up. I start to say, you know, what was I doing in Hawaii? My dad had a heart attack 3 months ago. I called my mom before we left. She said, yeah, he's doing fine. Go ahead and go. But the good son would have gone home and been with his mom when she needed him. I should have gone to Utah and been with my dad before he died. That's this AA stuff when I hear on these trips. It's just ego. I should have gone and been with my mom, my dad, before he died. And I'm right in the middle of beating myself up real bad. And over the paging system comes this page. And it says, will a friend of Bill W. pick up the white paging phone? I started laughing. Well, he needs a 12-step call. I picked up the phone and there was a young guy from Chicago. We met in a bar. And I said to him, I said, I've never heard of you page friends of Bill W. all the time? He said, never done it before. Just want to see if there are any drunks in Utah. His dad had died a year prior to that. We had a great hour meeting in that bar, in that coffee shop. You know? So that was for me. That one was for me. That's just a coincidence, isn't it? God ain't going to do that. But it is. It told me I'm right. See, my dad was going to die anyway. My primary purpose is to help other alcoholics. And I was right where I was supposed to do. Right where I was supposed to be doing what I was supposed to be doing. That's just a coincidence, isn't it? God ain't going to do that. I'm sure y'all have heard a lot of pages for Bill W. in airports. You know? Never heard one before or since, you know? That's just a coincidence. God ain't going to put just the right person at just the right time with just the right information in our lives to help us, is he? Since God works through people. I share that with you tonight because I know that there are some people in this room this morning in a lot of pain. Because life goes on when you get sober. It doesn't really seem to matter whether you've been sober 30 days or 20 years. Sometimes it hurts to be sober because life happens. And when you're in there, sometimes you just don't know, man. You can be sober 20 years and you're going through all that's stuck in life. It's like you've crawled over the edge of the precipice and you're looking into the abyss and you don't know. Does this God stuff really work? or do I need to go find another program? Do I need to get on something else to help me through this? I've worked all the steps. I've done everything. I've sponsored people. I've read the book a jillion times. And my life's miserable. What do I need to do? And if that's where you are, then you need to know that this morning I know more than ever that God loves us. He loves us. And God Himself will go to any lengths to see that you get it. I used to think that was a one-way street, that we had to be willing to go to any lengths to get sober. I know today that God will go to any lengths to see you get this deal. He loves you that much. And if you're having a rough time right now, which you're going to have, then you need to know that. And if you need to borrow my God till you can find a power of your own that will solve your problem, then do that. Because I've borrowed your God lots when I didn't know. And the God of my understanding today will go to any lengths to see you get well. But we have the only disease whose recovery was designed by God, including in that recovery, God. It's an incredible deal. Now, I don't know when God will help you, but I know exactly how God will help you. I know exactly how God is going to help you, no matter what your problem is. What God's going to do, He's going to put just the right person at just the right time with just the right information that you need. Because God works through people. And that's why our fellowship becomes so important. It's because you're the people that God's going to talk to me through. And I love you so much for that. I just love you with all my heart and thank you for inviting us to come share. Thank you.